So our first topic for the panel is to talk more deeply about the types of investments they're looking for, whether it might be income versus appreciation, and most importantly, expected returns. So broad topic, I'm gonna take this one in a different order, probably from the lowest returns and the safest returns up to more speculative. But Jim, why don't you start and take us through your investment types and your expected returns.
Sure, so as I mentioned before, we're in the bond side of the world. For our retail investors, we're looking for 9 to 12. We also have another class of investors for those deals that we buy for inventory, and they're looking for 15 to 25 with gusts over 30. We're being pretty cautious right now, as you heard some of the panelists in the prior panel. And the assets that we're looking to buy, we want a story. We want, even in the single tenant net lease world, we want some kind of a value add play. Either a tenant that may be bought out by another credit over time, or some kind of story with the location.
Jim, what about product type and size?
We are very diverse. All single tenant product types. And size of deals that we've acquired is anywhere from $5 million to $750 million.
And geography?
All over the country. Mm-hmm. We have historically been more in primary and secondary markets. We are wide open to any market if it's got the right story.
Mm-hmm. And then, Ed, I think I'm going to ask you to go next. Yours is a multifamily value add play, but tell us about your niche markets, what you're looking for from your investments and your expected returns.
Sure. We focus on major markets like LA and places like Pasadena, San Diego, Long Beach, and in Northern California, San Francisco, Oakland. These are all markets, if you're a multifamily buyer, that are obviously pretty tough to get pretty decent yields. So we generally offer our investors anywhere from a 12 to 13 net, which means we're really looking for a minimum gross 15. Most of the properties we're buying, whether they're rent stabilized or not, you know, we're sort of looking at 20 to 40% upside in rents from today's market, not sort of, you know, growing 6% a year. And for the most part, investors have a very long-term view. We have probably 20% of our investors in the industry, so they work for brokerage firms. Some couple are in the multifamily investment business, but they're in the institutional side, and we tend to buy sort of kind of niche-y, boutique-y buildings, which are just hard to get a hand of, and once you get them, you kind of want to hold them. So, when we managing investor capital, what we try to do is buy something, fix it, get the income up, refinance and de-risk investors. And that's typically, we're either de-risking by selling and maybe exchanging or by refinancing.
Do you have a rule of thumb on your hold period?
We will underwrite 5-year holds, which is, I guess, kind of industry standard. But if you canvassed our investors, 98% of them would say, please don't sell. So while we have a 5-year hold, it's really meant to kind of give a comparison to other deals we've shown them. But really, and we have a low pref, so we're not really incentivized to sell for a promote. We'd rather hold. So reality is our hold periods are much longer than 5 years. We've sold earlier to take, we sold deals in San Francisco for a sub-3 cap. And in those situations, we sort of said, you know what, the best thing for our investors is to sell out of this and either return the capital or exchange it.
And what kind of percentage actually go through the 1031 with you and carry on
100%
to the next project? Great.
Yeah, of all the of the ones we've done, 100%. And in some cases, we've had to raise more for the value add component, mm-hmm. And they've all stepped up their pro rata share.
Great, good success story. Danny, I'm going to turn to you next. Customized portfolios. There's a broad range of things you can do there.
Yeah. So we are predominantly in the 4 major food groups, but on the multifamily side, that spectrum's a little wider. That spectrum crosses over from affordable housing to senior housing, and then obviously market rate product. But we, again, we're focused on location. So for us, what our strategy and what we're, and why it's a compelling argument to invest through us to get to local operating partners is that we are trying to take out the location volatility out of the return and out of the risk and provide value add business plans to create the return that is generally more attractive to investors. We have capital that ranges from core plus to opportunistic. I would say over 65-70% of our portfolio is in value add, which turns into a core plus hold after the heavy lifting's done. And so our hold periods, because of our private capital, can be from 2 years to 15 years. So really, there's an ability to work with operators that have different types of hold strategies based on their original business plan. There's flexibility and the like. So I think that makes it a little bit more unique than a funds offering that has a lifetime that needs to be met within the 5 to 7 year range.
And are you also finding a high degree of exchanges on the back end?
So our family offices are call it smallest family office is $400 million, and our largest client is $6 billion. So exchanges are like not even a topic of conversation ever. Mm-hmm. So they have very complicated tax returns and have whole teams and consultants that work on a consolidated tax plan. So real estate has absolutely no influence in their tax planning with respect to 1031s.
And Mark, how about you? Coming from the family office perspective, why don't you tell us what you're looking for, debt, equity, your market play, and maybe your exit strategy as well.
Yeah, so first and foremost are risk-adjusted investors. I don't think we are looking to take on more risk for lower returns, especially in what looks like a rising interest rate environment. Sounds obvious, but that's kind of how we look at it. We're asset class agnostic. We don't do ground up development. Like Danny, we are not set up like a fund. So, I mean, look, if we want to hold an asset longer with a partner, we'll work it out. We go into the asset with ideally the same business plan going in. If we have an asset that we're looking to buy, our partner's looking at long term, we're looking at short term, probably not going to be a deal that we buy with that partner. But you know, we do stick to primary markets generally, and we've done some longer term kind of core plus-ish deals. We've done some more value add, but for us, it's again a really flexible mandate. Aside from sort of geography and markets we like to play in, so we don't have a policy. It's not like we have to get a 12 or a 20 or an 18. It's you know, if the partner and the sponsor is someone we want to do repeat business with, and the deal's nice, then we'll figure out a way to do it.
Great. And now that we know where each of you is coming from in your investment perspective, one of the things that we wanted to touch on, too, is just looking into that crystal ball. Compare a little bit your 2016 to what you think your 2017 and future might be. And, Jim, I'll start with you again.
Sure, we've been full throttle for about 3 years. And this year, we're starting to remember some of the deals that we did 9, 10, 11 years ago. And I've got more war stories than we have time to talk about, but let's just say we did some bad deals and we did some good deals. And the theme to the bad deals was we got lured by a strong credit and strong rent bumps. But if you've got 3% rent bumps in a lease that started in 2007 and then you go through a downturn, by the time you get to 2011, you've got a property with rents that are way above market. So we're really focusing on what's going to be the long-term value. Some people in prior panels were talking about wealth preservation over income, and I think that's definitely our perspective. So we're still looking for the story, we're still looking for the diamond in the rough, but we're being very careful.
Danny, how about your version of the story out there? What are you looking for in the new year compared to last year?
I would have to say 2016 was rough. I think finding risk-adjusted in our minds was very, very difficult. It was probably one of the lowest deployment of capital, which is fine because at the end of the day, we have long-term clients and investors, and our track record is over vintage years. So if we have a low deployment year, we're not penalized in any way. There's no load that I have to carry. So we have that availability and flexibility to deploy as we see fit. And I think 2017 will be probably the same. I'm hoping it's not, but it's likely going to be. I think there's a lot of expectations that still have not been adjusted in any way for change and risk and the like. So I think it's going to be a lot of the same.
Mark, you're nodding your head.
Yeah,
you agree? And where do you diverge?
Last year was rough for us, too. It felt very uncertain last year. I don't know if it was election or the economy or what it was, but we thought, given the uncertainty, you know, there'd be some opportunities out there. And so we hung around the hoop on a lot of things, and sellers just kind of said, I'm not going to sell. No one capitulated. They just said, I'm taking it off the market, or I'm not going to sell. So we were slow. I don't know what's going to happen this year. I have no idea. But we're open for business. We're not capital constrained. It feels like things after the election and the Treasury spike have sort of loosened up a little bit. People seem to be a little bit more, confident. But, you know, I can't be sure.
All right. And then, Ed, why don't you, I know you're bullish. Mm-hmm. You sense a good deal of activity coming. Tell us what you're seeing on the horizon in your niche.
Sure. So we had a pretty good year last year. We expect to do about 20% more this year. We have a deal closing this month and one next month. Part of our view is really, the asset class we're in. Fundamentals are really great for multifamily, especially urban. So we start with that and then say, okay, where rates might go. I actually think they're going to sort of moderate, but who knows. We price to a five-year loan, so that pricing today sort of just, we lock it and we're set for 5 years. Generally, we look at where we're going to be at the end of that five-year period in terms of cash on cash and in terms of what the debt yield is at that point that we might refi. One thing to understand is we don't over-leverage these properties, or maybe 60-65% debt. So by virtue of what we're buying and sort of where we're buying, by default, it's a pretty safe asset class, and we're not, I think we're capitalizing it to be pretty defensive. So we're pretty bullish. Fundamentals are great in California. San Francisco is definitely at the high end of the market, has slowed down. Rents are down 15-20%. But in Southern California, rents are, we think, pretty strong and will continue to be.
Terrific. We're going to switch gears a little bit on the next topic. And I know that this is probably going to be in the bailiwick of Danny and Mark more than the others. But the topic is joint ventures and rights and controls and how you align yourselves. And I'm looking forward to hearing about the capital process, not necessarily the deal process. And also looking forward to war stories and perhaps some red flags from some partners. No names. But Danny, why don't you take that one?
Sure.
And Mark, you know what? I'm going to give you free rein to jump in at any time. You might want to banter back and forth a little bit.
Fortunately, Mark and I feel, I think the many times we've spoken on the same panel, we have a very similar philosophy, which is, it's so imperative to find the right partner alongside the real estate. So for us, of course you can look to the real estate and underwrite it and have the metrics, but at the end of the day, if the partner's not right, it's a failed investment. And there's so much time and resources spent on finding the right partners that it is a challenge and a goal to find a partner that you can have repeat business with. Having said that, over the course of, you know, 10 years, the terms and rights of limited partners has only gained momentum and steam. So for us, it's been in our favor as LPs to have major control rights, review, approvals, the likes. So it's been great from an asset management and fiduciary of capital. I think it depends on also different operators, right? The bigger the operator and the more leverage they have in negotiating those operating agreements. And like, just the war stories are endless from all of us, regardless if we're in private capital, you know, in a, you know, an investment advisor or family office. And I think I always chuckle when an operator comes to us who sees our capital any differently than institutional, right? So they assume that we're not fee conscious or that we don't understand what typical pref rates and promotes. So once you get past all of that, at the end of the day, we are fiduciaries and we are registered investment advisors with the SEC and we have an obligation. And that's going to be influenced into all the docs, full stop, right? Operator doesn't perform, there are rights to remove them from that perspective, and we've done so on three occasions. So there's a
Can you give us one of those occasions without naming names?
Well, you'll never get a name. Yeah, you'll never get a name. I mean, I think the truth is when you have a small group that implodes in a downturn because fees change, you stop having the representation and the on-site hands that you need, our capital's at risk. And because we all come from a real estate background, we're going to protect the capital to the best of our abilities, and we're going to use our operating agreement to exercise those rights. Another, it's not a war story, but I kind of find it a little bit humorous. We recently closed this year on a transaction where our operating partner has institutional capital and also syndication model, and we're very clear about what fees and what costs will be passed back through the entity that owns the real estate. And sure enough, we get the first month report and there's this little fee, this little $400 shows up on the P&L, and my asset manager, you know, it doesn't raise any, it's not material, it's $500, just let it go. Next month, another 500. And so when I come on board, you know, into the weeds, it's a quarter. So now it's been 3 months and I'm like, what's this $2,000, you know, growing? Sure enough, they're charging something totally dumb, $5 a door accounting admin fee. I'm like, no. Like, I know it's immaterial. I know it doesn't matter, but like, that's not part of our arrangement. So it's that hidden, you know, passbacks that are so annoying. It's like, you know, there are legitimate costs that are associated with operating the business and having a flat dollar per door idea, just is that, that's just not institutional. So we like to educate our operators when they're talking to a group like us, which is this quasi type of capital in many viewpoints, that we are by all means institutional.
I'm going to go back to one of those broken deals and ask the question about control. Do you pull a chair right up next to your partner and co-manage, or do you actually try to take control if that's what's in your operating agreement? Talk about some of those struggles a little bit.
It depends on what expertise they bring, right? So if they're really strong with leasing and tenant relations, then we're going to, you know, and that's the skill that they bring to the table, but they're lacking in infrastructure and back office, we can supplement that. But if they've just failed because they've imploded and they're now looking at the next deal because there's no promote left in this, and then there's not worth the property management fee, and I already took my ACC fee, yeah, they're out. So it just really depends on the deal and where we are in the mess that I have to come to that place.
Right, and I bet Mark's got some wisdom on that too.
I've seen those accounting statements. There was a bowl game I didn't get invited to. The tickets were passed through. that's a true story. So I would say, yeah, I agree with everything Danny said. I'd say philosophically, I mean, look, we look for everything that's typical in an operating partner, but philosophically we look for someone that thinks alike, you know, thinks the same that we do. we typically don't fit, and we've had to learn this a little bit, with people who are constantly doing deals, because we are not constantly doing deals. You know, for us, it's more about the partner, and the first deal, it's sort of date before you get married, learn a little about us, we want to learn a little about you, we don't have to round trip a deal to do the second one, but let's just feel it out a little bit. Sometimes we'll do a deal, and then a sponsor will show us their entire pipeline of, you know, 50 deals. So here you go. And if we say no, then they're off to the next partner. And then it's sort of like a weird, strained relationship. And we've had, you know, experience with that. I think it's very, very short, you know, or narrow-minded, because those folks are often the folks that are constantly looking for money, I find. Because they end up coming back to us through intermediaries. Oh, you should talk to, you know, these guys. But that's something we really look for in a partner, is someone who, you know, thinks alike. And some of our more successful partners, candidly, we have one group who don't own any assets. They've sold everything. And I know there's a conundrum, right? Because people got to keep the lights on and everything, but they've sold everything because they think everything's too expensive. So. It's an interesting data point. It's an extreme, but yeah. And so the control thing, yeah. I mean, typical kind of control provisions. We've never removed anyone from we've had to remove anyone from a venture, but you know, really the transparency and communication and you know, philosophically thinking the same is something we really look to.
And I'm going to put the same tough question to you about got a broken deal. Time to renegotiate, perhaps, realign. How do you handle those things? I know it's different for every project, but how do you approach it in general?
Well, first I started with how the sponsors kind of acted throughout the relationship. If it's someone that's acted, you know, it's been forthright, you know, has integrity, has done everything possible they can, it's a much different conversation. If it's someone who hasn't, you know, it's another conversation. But look, that's why partners are so important to us, first and foremost. You know, we're going to make mistakes, and that's just the nature of it. But, you know, we're going to try and work through it, and if everyone's transparent and forthright with us, it's an easier kind of deal to you know. We've had some issues, and thankfully, it's been with partners who have been really good, and we've just worked it out. I mean, we can look to the document and see what, you know, we can and can't do, but, you know, we get on the phone and we just work it out. So, pretty simple.
Well, I'm going to transport us to another topic, and this is going back out to the panel. So, Ed and Jim, inviting you back in. We're out on the lawn. You have your money dripping from your pockets, and there are prospective deals coming your way. What is it that you can tell our audience about the things that are important in deals coming to you to attract your capital? So go ahead, Ed, we'll start.
It is a great question, and I think it's evolving day to day in our internal conversations. As I said before, we've just been buying everything in sight for the last several years, and now we're becoming more careful. And what I want to see is something that has a long-term story. It's almost like I'm a stock picker now, and I want to figure out how is this company or this business going to become more valuable over time. And it's not just going to be a few numbers in a pro forma and projected returns. There's going to be much more thought given to that particular project. Someone came to me today with a deal, and when he just gave me the highlights, I said, no, that doesn't really fit our criteria. But then as we started to talk more, it was outside of our box, but he started to tell the story. And I said, okay, I can see how this could be a credit value play over time. And it can ride out a cycle. One story about 10, 11 years ago, we bought a property in San Jose. We paid too much for it. and we put too much debt on it. And it was leased to a tenant that never actually, it was a 15-year lease with bumps. The tenant never actually occupied the property. So we paid too much, rents are growing faster than the market, the tenant's not in the property. But there's a story. It's a volatile market, so it has ups and it has downs. And if we hold it long enough, we're going to ride it to another up, and there's something happening in the business community there that's going to create value. It ended up being one of our home runs, even though out of the gate it failed any institutional underwriting criteria, because there was a story and there was a reason why that particular project could gain value over time. So that's what we're looking for.
You know what, Mark? I'm going to come to you next. Mix it up here. You've been trailing edge, so we'll put you out front. I know it's easy to do the second and the third deal. What about the first deal that's coming to you? And you talked a lot about the integrity of the partner. Is there a particular story that you're looking for, or is it just return-driven?
No, absolutely not return-driven. Why are they coming to us? We get a lot of, so we play lower middle market primarily, so we get a lot of calls from syndicators saying, oh, you're that $8 million equity check I've been looking for. You know, here's my terms I've been getting. They're 50 after a 6 or 50 after an 8. And it's, you know, and we typically don't invest, you know, alongside our partners. So that's a very quick conversation. It's really, let's learn about each other. Like, what have you done? You know, how do you feel about the market? Like, let's look at your underwriting. You know, it's just kind of like get to know you. And look, I'm a fiduciary for a family, and we want to do business with really good people. And doesn't mean you have to have a sterling, you've never had a problem before. But if you had a problem, how'd you deal with it? Does that lender still lend to you? Things like that. So I'd say it's first deal's the hardest, no question about it. First deal's the hardest. But once we can kind of get a deal done, then it gets much, much easier.
And Ed, how about you? It's a little bit different situation for you, but you want to comment on the same thing about what you're looking for in deals and
sure.
Attracting capital?
So because we're very, very focused on one particular asset class in one state, in the markets we look at, you know, we have a pretty active understanding of each of the markets we play in. I can tell you where rents are in Pasadena. I can tell you where rents are for the stuff we do in San Diego, in San Francisco, wherever. So our great deal is an owner who's owned it for 25 or 30 years. Someone passed, and now it's the kids, and now they owned it for a year, and they didn't realize how hard their parents worked, and now all they want to do is sell it. Or someone ran out of depreciation and want to buy a net lease, Rite Aid or something, and they haven't really put money in the property, so the market's moved way ahead of them and they just sort of ignored it. So it's pretty easy for us to sort of focus on the right property. We're very, as I said, very particular about location, so we sift through a lot of assets and throw a lot of stuff out just on location. And then once, if it's a location we like, that's the first thing. Then we look at sort of what's the story behind the seller. If it's someone who, as I said, if it's someone who's owned it for a long time and there's a transition of some kind, then we know we've got a real seller. We're not going to waste a lot of time sort of someone just testing the market. If it's a flipper, someone's owned it for 3 years and now they're flipping it, we're probably not going to focus on it. And then it's just the hard work of figuring out what we need to do to the property. How much CapEx is involved. We just walked from a deal up in Northern California because there was just too much seismic issues. There was too many other things. Loved the market, liked our price, but physically there was just too many unknowns that we were gonna have to deal with. And so we moved along. So we kiss a lot of frogs every year to do 8 or 10 deals. I mean, we probably look at 700-ish properties in some form, whether we glance at it or whether we put it under contract.
And Danny, how about you? Same theme, and start there, that projects are harder to find these days, and I know substance is important, so maybe you can segue into getting past the fluff and getting to the substance more quickly.
Okay, if we're keeping on themes, and you're kissing frogs, and you're dating, I definitely go to first base faster. So what that means is that I don't date as long as you. I definitely kiss, but I get married. Here's the truth. We see a lot of deals. The deal has to make sense. And then I'll take the time to get to know a new operator. And they're usually in tandem. I have some operating partners in the room, and you know better than anybody, that we meet a lot of operators. And without a deal in tow, it's hard to really grasp what you're talking about and to get our attention. So if you're wearing a short skirt and you have a deal, I want to talk to you faster than when you don't. I'm playing on words, but the truth is, like, my job is to deploy capital with good deals and good managers. So I do want to get to know you, but not as long as Mark takes. So I'll just leave it at that.
I don't know how to fit into this.
I told you you'd be talking about this up at the bar. We have one short little last topic, and that one is about competition. Obviously, there's a lot of money out there. Friends and family money, life companies, foreign money banks. I'm going to open it up to whoever wants to start out. Where do you find your competition?
Mark's my competition.
I mean, look, capital at the end of the day is a commodity. I mean, it just is, especially nowadays. There's just a lot of money out there. Even though we sort of, again, play in a sandbox that's, I wouldn't call as competitive as, you know, the larger institutional sandbox, it's still competitive. And at the end of the day, you want to do deals with people you like, you can trust, and this is a relationship business. At the end of the day, that's what it is. And, you know, that's kind of how we try and separate ourselves.
I like what Mark has said a couple of times, which is emphasizing relationship. And I think our competition is anything that the world is seeing. And where we can be successful is where we have a relationship with something, where something might come to us first, or it might be off market, or because there's a high level of trust, we're going to be able to negotiate something more easily and more quickly, as you were talking about. So I think, again, it's having those relationships that are proven that allow us to see things and evaluate things with complete openness and transparency, as opposed to just all the stuff that's flowing that everybody's looking at.
For us, it's clearly, on the capital side, it's clearly, you know, long-term relationships and success in the past. So, it's kind of a mixture of both. For some of our investors, we're the only people they invest with for their private sort of, you know, real estate money, and they probably have, you know, all their other assets in bonds and stocks or houses. There are other investors of ours who do invest with other sponsors in real estate. It may be other apartment guys, maybe people who do industrial. But the reality is, we never feel like we're competing for that capital. The reality is, if it's an interesting deal, they're going to want to do it. We also have 180 investors, so in any given deal, we probably have 25 or 30. So it's very easy for us to fill a syndicate. We go hard with our own capital. We don't even put out a memo until we know we're closing the deal, and then we raise money in about a week or two. So from that side, we have no competition. From the property side, you know, it's really guys like us, and it's exchange people for the most part. And the reality is, you win based on your ability to close quickly, go hard quickly. We have no investment committee. My partners and I decide we want to do a deal, we do it. We live and die by the success, because if we can't raise the money, we lose our deposits. So it's an interesting dynamic, but we've been doing this for long enough now. We've closed 40 deals over the last 6 years, and we've never not closed a deal we went under contract with. We've never not been able to raise capital.
I think that's a perfect note to end on after the day and after the weekend here is relationships. I like that. We have just a little bit of time if there are any questions from the audience. Any hands? Here in the middle.
Who does ground out? Anybody?
Question?
No, me.
I think there's no ground up and there are no tertiary markets.
We have done limited ground up and we're not looking to do it right now.
Up front.
So question for Mark and Danny. What do you require? What do you require for OMS number one and number two? Since you are taking an active role as a limited partner, does that expose you to liability as a general partner in the deal?
Okay, your first question, it's a standard 10%. There's been variations that we have some of our JV partners that have put up 30 and 40%. I mean, so it's really deal, I would say specific, but general rule of thumb is 10% co-invest. And then your second question was about liability as it relates to the GP-LP?
Yes.
Or my role?
If you're making decisions as an LP, doesn't that expose you to the same liability as a general partner?
No.
Okay.
And it's defined in your operating agreement what that, you know, what those liabilities are. I mean, they're all spelled out. I mean, you could still get sued, don't get me wrong. I mean, that's a given. But I mean, the liabilities will be spelled out.
Any other questions? That's it. Thanks very much for your time.